A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to like get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none who get left.
We are all evil. Some foreign lawyer nugget.
I am not guilty.
I have kind of a short case for you today that I'm trying to make heads or tails of, mostly about what happened in Connecticut and the legal system in regards to this particular case. And it actually isn't so much like a case like I normally do, is kind of an opinion piece, which is my opinion, of which you are free to agree and disagree. And I actually welcome your opinion on this one. This is the murders of John Bell and Mary Rose Rietsch. Now, today's case takes place in Enfield, Connecticut, which is in Hartford County. The town houses about 45,000 people and is 89.74% Caucasian. Now, unfortunately, I don't really know much about Mary Rose Rietsch, who was 72 in 2021, and her boyfriend, John Samuel Bell, who was 63. But I know that Mary Rose was a grandmother. I know that much, at least. Neighbors at their home on Alden Avenue, which was more like, it's like a series of apartments that were set inside a converted large, like colonial style house, described the couple as having the biggest hearts, who were enjoying their golden years with time with family, trips to the beach, and going camping. Mary Rose had a rather complicated relationship with her granddaughter, 22-year-old Harley Swoles. Now, Harley was living with Mary Rose at the Alden Apartment Avenue, and I don't know much about her history either, like whether she was raised by her parents or Mary Rose. I know that her date of birth is April 25th, 1999, and I know that she was working at Staples at the time at Brookside Plaza, and that kind of tells me that she was stable enough to be working at least. But I don't think she was functioning at like a full adult level. So I can't actually comment on her mental health status really, but she did not apparently have any substance use issues. And I don't know if John Bell lived with Mary Rose or if they were just dating. It sounds like if he didn't live there exclusively, he definitely spent a large amount of time there. And I'm also not sure when he entered the picture as far as being in Mary Rose's life. Now, I'm sorry, I apologize for having such little background information, but I just could not dig up very much. And that kind of confounds me as to how this case plays out. I do know that Mary Rose was Harley's maternal grandmother. And on July 7th of 2021, police were called to the apartment, I believe by Mary Rose, who was the one that called. Now, Officer Joshua Pinkser, he was the one that responded. Apparently that morning, Harley had come out of the bathroom wrapped only in a towel and was holding her toothbrush and kind of waving it at John, accusing him of putting a scab on it, which is disgusting. To think about that. Now, John responded by saying, like, I don't see a scab and I didn't put one there, something to that effect. And at that point, Harley swung a punch at John, and he then defended himself, which resulted in the struggle. Now, John managed to break free of the struggle and ran into the bedroom, but Harley had sort of pushed her way in and threw a cup of coffee at him, grabbing him again, and then she was like pushing her finger into his eye and scratching him on his face and arms. So Mary Rose managed to get them separated and kept them in separate rooms until Officer Pinkster arrived. Harley told Officer Pinkster that John had started the fight and that she had just done what she had to do to defend herself. But Mary Rose said, no, that was not true. So Harley was charged with third degree assault on an elderly person and second degree breach of peace. So she was also put under a protection order, or like a restraining order, and of course not allowed to be anywhere near the apartment. So after being released on bond, she then went to stay with her other grandmother, like her paternal grandmother, Lynn Olden, and was living in her basement on Booth Road, which is only about a 5-minute drive from Alden Avenue. Now, I don't think she had a very close relationship with Lynn, because according to Lynn herself, she was only there for about a month and never addressed Lynn by name or even called her Nana or Grandma or anything like that. And this could be part of the background information that would be really nice to know what the sort of the dynamics were of Harley's life. However, the prosecutor attorney's office later said that there was no documented mental health issues with Harley, although that could be that the family was kind of trying to deal with it inside of the family, but I have no idea on that. At 6:37 p.m. on August 8th, 911 received a call from one of the downstairs neighbors reporting that there was something going on upstairs in Mary Rose's apartment and that someone was calling for help. So two officers, Whitcomb and Roche, responded and they came up to the second floor. There was kind of like a porch entryway, and saw that there had been a window smashed, and inside they could see Mary Rose. She was laying face up in a pool of blood, but they could see her chest rising and falling. Now, this is all according to the arrest affidavit. So they kicked in the door, and that is when Harley emerged from this doorway to the kitchen, but they could tell that she had come originally from the bathroom, where they could hear the shower was running. She was fully clothed but soaking wet and still covered in this watery red blood. So Harley was arrested, but they didn't really know what they had on their hands there. So she was initially just charged with violating a protection order because, of course, she wasn't supposed to be there.
Police on scene for more than 10 hours on Alden Ave after a couple, 63-year-old James Samuel Bell and 72-year-old Mary Rose Riach, were killed late Sunday.
The 22-year-old granddaughter of the female victim has been arrested. At this point, she is charged only with a violation of a protective order that had been issued in relation to an earlier dispute between the parties, that having occurred on July 7th, 2021, at that same address.
Harley Swoles is not charged in connection to the homicide. She only faced a judge today for allegedly violating a protective order from back in July of this year. Records also show she has previous misdemeanor charges of assaulting elderly and breaching of peace. And after yesterday's killings, more charges could come.
The police will be doing further investigation, given that when they arrived on scene, they did find the two victims in the matter, one already deceased, another severely injured, later deceased.
John Bell was found in the bedroom, kind of on his knees, but facing downwards. He was clearly deceased based on the large gash on his neck that was going from ear to ear and the massive amount of blood that was pooled beneath him. Mary Rose had a very faint pulse, also had a large slash wound to her neck. So she was rushed to the Bay State Hospital, but she was pronounced dead at 8:34 p.m. At the autopsies, it was noted that Mary Rose had 22 sharp force injuries. Some were slashes, some were defense wounds. Her cause of death had been the large cut to her jugular vein. John Bell had suffered 30 stab wounds. 12 of them had been on his arms and hands. Most of them were actually penetrating wounds. There were 5 stab wounds to the head and face, and then this large neck wound, which was about 5 inches long, and then another 14 penetrating wounds on his upper back around like the shoulder area. Carly, when she was arrested, had a lot of blood on her hands, and her hands had also had some superficial cuts on them. She also had some rips in her jeans around the legs and on the backside. So I don't think it was a huge question as to who had stabbed Mary Rose and John, but rather why and what had led up to it. Now, here is the part that starts to kind of confound me. Harley is brought in for questioning, obviously, and this is difficult for the podcast because I have to kind of describe to you her actions during the questioning. I will play a little bit of it for you for YouTube, but like just so you can get a sense of what I'm talking about. Now, I found this footage on Red Tree Stories, and if you want to watch the whole thing, of course, I'm not going to play the whole thing because number one, it belongs to Red Tree Stories. And because she doesn't really say anything important or interesting in it, it's more about her actions. Now, what you can't see on the podcast is that she comes into the room and she's wearing her staple shirt, like from work, and is having some tics or like twitches, much like Tourette syndrome. Now, she never really addresses the tics to the officers, and they do their best to kind of ignore it, which is actually a good move, because if they are legitimate, you don't want to make the person with the tics more nervous or self-conscious, because of course they can get a lot worse. And if she's faking it, then you don't want to give her the attention.
You diagnosed or anything? I noticed she's pushing a little bit. Is that just, do you normally do that? You know what that is, or is it just like a nervous type thing, or? You don't think any medications are helpful? Or do you know where you're at right now?
Go to the police station.
Okay. So, Detective Lewis, I guess I'm just in second mail. All right. You're at the police department, and I have a seat. So, right now, because you're in the police station, are you able to talk?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, because you're at the police station here,
so maybe I've got VGR rights.
Now, personally, I think she's faking them. And the reason that I feel that way is that the tics, like tics are a chronic condition. And I don't know a lot about them, to be fair. But my understanding is that they are normally associated with some facial tics and vocalizations that are really hard to control. And that they come in spurts, like they aren't constant. Now, hers appear to be constant. Now, Tourette's syndrome is apparently diagnosed. Now, again, I'm not a doctor. This is according to my online research, so I want to be completely transparent in that. But is diagnosed as having both motor and vocal tics. Now, Harley doesn't have any vocal tics, so that would leave a tic like anxiety kind of disorder, which is a thing. And the tics are normally associated in those cases with like sort of the head and shoulder area, and there will be sort of blinking or some nose twitching, and can also include things like tapping objects or people, clapping, imitating other people's movements. Now, she doesn't do any of that. It's just this constant head twitching and kind of flailing her arms about. Now, she also doesn't repeat words or do any throat clearing, which can also be associated with tic disorders. Now, I am going to desperately try to remember to link the video in my show notes here, because I do not want you to take my word for it. Like, I am very aware that I don't know much about tics, and they can be associated with some mental health issues, things like ADHD, depression, and of course, anxiety, and can come as a side effect to some antipsychotic drugs, stimulants. But Harley says she doesn't take any medications.
So when you say you got a hand, what does that mean?
Nothing.
Well, I mean something. You said it, so I want to know. I want to help you explain your story.
Or Haley, wait.
We obviously know something went on in the house, right? And there could be 10 different reasons as to why what happened in that house happened, right? We're here now could be talking to you, and there could be a reason that makes us understand why things happened that you know, and we're looking for you to tell us that. And you might be a little bit nervous to tell us, but without you telling us your version of it, we're only left with one picture. And I don't want to be left with that one picture. I want to hear, you said things got out of hand. What did your grandmother do?
And this dramatic flailing about just seems very forced. Like she's putting more effort into remembering to keep them up than she does to paying attention to what she's being asked. But I am not sure what her strategy is for this, if she's faking it. Like tics aren't a get out of jail free card of not being able to control your movements and then leading to a total of 52 stab wounds. And it's not also a full blown sign of legal insanity. So I'm not really sure what her agenda is there, if she's faking it. I would be really interested in hearing from someone that suffers from a tic disorder to sort of letting me know, like, if I'm completely off base here, because, like, I'm not trying to say anything negative about a person having tics. I imagine that is not a great thing to have happen to you neurologically, and I'm sure it has physical effects and can also impact your mental health. But I think that why this bothers me so much is that if she's faking, like, that's offensive to me. But anyways, there is a little bit later where these tics completely stop when she's having her mugshot taken. Like, she's completely able to stand still while she takes several photos.
So, Holly, because you asked for an attorney, we can't talk to you anymore.
Okay, it's fine. Is there a way you could set my finger, though, maybe?
Well, set it?
Or something.
Oh, is it this way?
It really hurts. I don't know.
Well, yeah, well, so we'll get an ambulance to come take a look at it. And they're not going to be able to do x-rays or anything, but they can at least check it out and feel it. Maybe they'll be able to see if it's broken or something.
Okay.
Face this way. So we're gonna take some overall photos of you, and they'll probably take some close-up photos as well. If you can just stand. Yeah. Can you get her in the whole picture?
Yeah.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
And I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Like, 'cause I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
So I think that's a little bit odd. I would think that seeing that she couldn't even stop for like 2 seconds for the 22 minutes beforehand. Now, if the tics are real, I guess that doesn't really matter. It's just a thing that I initially noticed, and I wondered how it kind of fits into the rest of the story of how it goes. And she also stands perfectly still during her court hearings. Anywho, all she says in this interview is that she worked at Staples. She left her workplace that evening and took an Uber to her grandparents' place to pick up some clothes, that kind of thing. And then I guess she'd left there behind. She was then going to get something to eat and then run some errands. And that Mary Rose had opened the door for her and invited her in, and things got out of hand. But she doesn't remember anything after that. But then she says, but there was no argument. No one was yelling. She didn't do anything and nothing happened. She does not appear to be anxious or upset or any emotion that would sort of lead me to believe that these tics are real. So if you didn't know by now, my personal opinion is that she is a faker pants. You may feel differently, and I'm definitely open to hearing your take on that. And actually, I just want to take some of the summarized notes of this interview from the Enfield police for your own notes that I'm sure you are taking. So she first thing she did is she waived her Miranda rights. She confirmed that she is not on any medication and doesn't drink or do any drugs. And she doesn't have any issues with remembering things normally. She stated that there was this argument and it wasn't good. But then she stated that she did not remember what wasn't good. She said it escalated so quickly, but when she was questioned a little bit further about that, she couldn't explain like how it escalated. She said that she had a black knife that was from the house that she had picked up. And she was asked then where the knife was when she picked it up. And she said that she guessed it must have been in John's pocket when she showed up. She said that the knife was sort of introduced into this argument and that John had come at her with the knife and that she tried to push him, but it didn't work. She then said that she got the knife. And then, like, what happened next? She said, not good things, clearly. She did not want to say what had happened when she got the knife because it was not good. She said that she was in the bedroom with both Mary Rose and John, and she had pushed John. She then stated that she picked up the knife from the bedroom, and then when she picked it up, she hurt someone with the knife. But she would not elaborate on who she had hurt. And then that's when she requested the services of a lawyer. Okay, so Harley lawyers up by asking very clearly for a lawyer, and her interview ends at that time. So they talked to the Uber driver, who was still actually parked at the back of the house on Alden Avenue when the police had arrived. Now, he had a little bit of some interesting things to add to Harley's version of events. So the Uber driver was a guy named Kareem, who picked her up outside of the Staples at Brookfield Plaza around 4 p.m. that afternoon. She was wearing her red Staples shirt and some jeans. She was, of course, dry at that time without any blood on her at all and any rips in her jeans. She said that she actually had a couple of stops to make, and Kareem told her that, well, you'll have to add the stops into the Uber app. Now, her phone was near dead, so she used Kareem's charger to plug in her phone and then added two stops. She added 97 Elm Street and Gatewood Drive. Now, I'm not sure what those two addresses were about, because according to Google Maps, they aren't all that close to Alden Avenue, but they definitely arrived at the Alden Avenue apartment complex. And she told him to park in the back, which he did. And then, of course, the back of the residence is where the steps are that lead up to the second floor where Mary Rose's apartment is. And when she got out of the car, she slammed the door. And so Kareem said something like, you know, why'd you slam the door? And she apologized, saying sorry, and then walked up the stairs to Mary Rose's apartment. And about 4 minutes later is when he heard some glass break and the sounds of just breaking things in general at the top of the stairs, and then a woman yelling, help, help. And this ruckus lasted for about 5 minutes. And just when he was going to go call the police is when they actually showed up on the scene. Now, he stuck around to see this now dripping wet and bloody Harley being taken out of the house in handcuffs, and then paramedics rushing into the apartment. So her charges were upgraded a couple of days after this incident to 2 counts of murder, and she was held on a $2 million bond. So that's all pretty normal thus far. Well, not the murder part, but the arrest and the charges. Now, in Connecticut, there is a charge called murder with special circumstances, which rather than the 25 to life, comes with life with no parole, and murder of more than one person in the course of a single transaction, which I did not choose the word transaction. Legal analysts did that, qualifies as special circumstances. But I cannot confirm if she was formally charged with that. I actually can't confirm very much here because I could not find any documents related to her trial. Like nothing, not at all. Not even a blurb on the news or any little teeny tiny article about what happened between August of 2021 and when she was arraigned, and May of 2025 when she filed her appeal. Now, the fact that she filed an appeal would suggest to me that she had been convicted. And I do understand that there were rumors around the time that she would be going with a defense tactic of kind of a combination of self-defense and mental health defects. That also does not surprise me. A lot of perfectly sane people try to claim insanity. But what did surprise me is that the fact that she was actually acquitted by reason of insanity or mental defect or whatever you want to call it. But she so clearly, in my opinion, was faking it. Like, how could a jury or a judge or whatever it was find her legitimately insane at the time of the crime? Like, how is that even possible? Now, as a refresher for you, legal insanity is very hard to prove. And even if you are successful at proving it, you do not go free. Like, you are still locked up in a psychiatric hospital and you can stay there indefinitely if you never become sane again. In Harley's case, she was committed, not sentenced, because it is technically not a guilty thing. So she got 50 years for each murder, so 100 years total of committal. Now, she's appealing it because that's actually not the correct commitment under Connecticut law. There is apparently a 60-year maximum. However, letting one back out into the community is still up to the psychiatric review committee of the particular state. So successful insanity defenses usually involve severe delusions, like Satan told me to do it, hallucinations that are not caused by hallucinating substances. In my mind, I swear I was killing a bear. I didn't realize it was a person. And no awareness that what was done was wrong, which would indicate that any actions taken to cover up a crime would preclude that kind of defense. Mental health is obviously a very broad subject, and clearly those that take other people's lives have some mental health issues in a lot of cases. But personality disorders, being a narcissistic or greedy twat, high on meth, or psychological liars and sociopaths need not apply. I believe in all of my years of true crime research and reading, psychosis is about the only diagnosis that ever actually works, like postpartum or schizophrenia type of psychosis. In my mind and in the world in which that I live, which is clearly delusional, there are a few things that would exclude an insanity defense for Harley, like at all. Like, let's say she does have paranoid schizophrenia that hasn't been treated or diagnosed until now. Hence why she hallucinated the scab on her toothbrush back in July and had to fight that out physically with John to defend herself or whatever. She clearly goes in and out of this psychosis because she has a job. And there were no reported incidents with her that day during her shift. She was able to not just get an Uber, but use like a phone charger and update the app with addresses that do exist. And she apologized for slamming the car door too hard. And then she took a shower to try and wash the blood off of her clothes and body. And even if her twitching and itching was all real, she had the ability to stand still for her mugshot, and twitching and itching has nothing to do with her knowledge of right and wrong. So what the heck happened in Connecticut? Well, under Connecticut law, for successful criminal insanity, you have to prove that at the time of the crime was committed, you were more likely than not lacking the substantial capacity by way of mental defect to appreciate the wrongfulness of your conduct or control it within the requirements of the law. And like most places, you can't voluntarily use intoxicants, claim a gambling addiction or antisocial behaviors drove you to it. That's all pretty normal. And the insanity defense is actually only used in about 1% of felony trials, and it's only successful in about a quarter of those. Now, before I go on to talk about the stuff that I uncovered in my research, I want to make it really clear that I have no idea the specifics of the judge or the jury's decision in this specific case as to how or why she was acquitted. But I have a feeling it has to do with this stuff that I'm going to be talking about. But I just want to reiterate that I cannot relate this back directly to Harley Sewell's specific case. I like to just sort of talk about the things that my research leads me to. So normally in assessing a person with who's claiming a mental defect during their assessment, they use what is called this cognitive prong. And the use of this cognitive prong is usually referred to as the McNaughton rule. But what isn't normal in this case is this added layer under Connecticut law called volitional prong. And in most places, there is only the one prong, and that would be the cognitive prong, which is at the time of the offense, did the person have the ability to appreciate the moral wrongfulness and the nature of their actions? Now, this volitional prong is more commonly known as the irresistible impulse test, which is then added to the McNaughton rule in 16 states, including Virginia, Texas, and Colorado. Now, Kansas, Idaho, Montana, and Utah have outright abolished the legal insanity defense, so don't even try it there. Normally, as I mentioned, under like normal legal standards, the law looks at cognitive function. So your ability or your knowledge of criminal laws, wrongfulness, and then excludes or doesn't consider your ability to perceive reality and make rational decisions based in reality, which isn't really required when you're talking about somebody that, say, shoots through their apartment window at strangers, believing he is doing God's work in slaying demons. But, like, what about your ability to control your actions? Like, should that come into play? So this irresistible impulse model can then take into consideration things like racing thoughts, impulsive behavior, and elated energy, which would include conditions like ADHD and bipolar disorder. But, like, how do you decide how much of that condition is really affecting your ability to control your actions? And the reason that so many states have abandoned this part is that there is no specific way to measure this. Like, how do you measure a person's ability to make choices and whether or not they considered any other alternative actions, and like how they managed to come to their decision? And any expert testimony would come down then to a jury's subjective opinion of their interpretation of the person's thinking. Now, I read a paper that was written by Dr. Ira Packer of the Law and Psychiatry Program at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. It was called Assessing the Volitional Prong of the Insanity Defense. I actually read a few articles, some of it for and some of it against it, for like a balanced perspective. Now, Dr. Packer in her paper gives this example. A schizophrenic man walks into a bank and hands a note to the teller demanding $10,000, threatening to detonate a grenade, like if he doesn't get his money. So he indicates to the forensic examiner that he chose this particular bank rather than any others in the area, because he knew that it was not going to be crowded. He also chose to threaten with a grenade, which he didn't really have, thankfully, because he thought that it would be easier to fake that than claiming he had a gun. And he explained to this forensic examiner that he had heard the voice of God telling him that if he did not get this $10,000 and distribute it to his mother and to the poor, that he would die. So he decided that going with this particular bank was the best way to fulfill this commandment that he was given and avoid the consequences of getting caught. So in this case, he says that one could argue that although he demonstrated the ability to choose between alternative means of obtaining the money, he was so influenced by his delusions and hallucinations that his capacity to choose to not then commit any criminal act was significantly impaired. But one has to look more closely at whether or not the person took steps prior and after the crime to avoid apprehension, which fairly, I think, Harley did not do. She didn't take any steps to avoid being arrested. She took an Uber to the location, which she knew could be traced, and she was arrested without any argument about it. However, she did attempt to take a shower, which the prosecution and probably myself would argue was an attempt to sort of clean off any evidence from herself. However, I don't think it was a very well thought out plan. I will definitely give her that. Dr. Parker goes on to write that as the American Psychiatric Association had written in their 1983 statement on this insanity defense, the line between an irresistible impulse and an impulse not resisted is probably no sharper than that between twilight and dusk. An illegal act committed while in a psychotic state doesn't necessarily mean that a person lacks the ability to conform their behavior to within the scope of the law. And then, of course, she further brings up the subject of this malingering, which is the fakey pants stuff. Now, experts claim, apparently, that malingering and actual mental illness can coexist, that a person can exaggerate or even fake symptoms and yet still be mentally ill enough to legally qualify under the legal definition of insanity, to which I kind of call bullshit on that, but it's difficult to get a jury to buy that. And on that, I would definitely agree. So what the heck happened in this case then? Like, was she really able to take an Uber and function at a job yet was completely unable to control her behavior and just kind of accidentally stabbed a knife that she got from the kitchen 52 times into her grandparents with no ability to perceive any other option and then took a shower? And where does this twitching and itching come in? Like, was that part of her inability to control her actions? Was it actually real? Was it completely faked for some attention getting, like to try to look like she was insane? I have questions. So please leave your comments of what you think down below. And I'm very interested to hear what you think about this. In the meantime, I'll be back with another case probably in a week. And as always, thank you so much for watching and for listening.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to like get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.